Again, that's Seema, Sacred Dance of the Whirling Dervishes, Sunday, June 24th at 3:30 p.m. at the New Expressive Works, 810 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is artist, writer, and journalist Molly Crabapple. Molly Crabapple first made a name for herself as an artist in the world of burlesque, as a model for The Suicide Girls, a burlesque performer herself, and the house artist of the notorious New York City nightclub, The Box. During that time, she also illustrated comics, and while there was a political element to some of Crabapple's work at the time, her work took a decidedly political turn in 2011 with the uprising of the Arab Spring, the student protests in London, and Occupy Wall Street, which unfolded just outside her studio apartment in Zuccotti Park. Her studio became an impromptu salon for the artists and journalists of the Occupy movement, and Crabapple began to create her singular style of art journalism with the art she produced as part of these protests. Matt Taibbi dubbed her the greatest of the Occupy artists, and Crabapple went on to illustrate Taibbi's book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap, and Lori Penny's Discordia, which chronicled the Greek economic crisis. Since then, Crabapple has become well-known as a long-form journalist, as well as a formal innovator creating a unique marriage of journalism, visual art, and literature. Her reportage has been published in the New York Times, the New York Review of Books, the Paris Review, Vice, The Guardian, and elsewhere. Crabapple's illustrated journalism, her marriage of words and art, has chronicled the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, labor camps in Abu Dhabi, the military commissions of Guantanamo detainees, the Syrian refugee crisis, and the history of transgender rights. She has collaborated with everyone from the ACLU, Human Rights Watch, and Amnesty International, to Jay-Z, Spike Jonze, and Esperanza Spalding. Her art is in the permanent collections of the Library of Congress, the New York Historical Society, and the Museum of Modern Art. The Guardian described her work as equal parts Hieronymus Bosch, William S. Burroughs, and Cirque du Soleil, and Time magazine named her one of its next generation leaders, saying her work is a perfect slow media commentary on our current fast media climate. In 2015, Crabapple published her illustrated memoir, Drawing Blood, the story of her coming of age as both an artist and a writer, a book that received raves from Salman Rushdie, Joe Sacco, Chris Abani, and Joss Whedon. She's here today on Between the Covers to talk about her latest illustrated book, co-written with the Syrian journalist Marwan Hisham and illustrated by Crabapple, entitled Brothers of the Gun, a memoir of the Syrian war. Anand Gopal says the following about Brothers of the Gun. Marwan Hisham took part in the uprising against Bashar al-Assad and then did the unthinkable, wrote journalism from inside ISIS territory, risking his life so that the world might know the truth. He gives us an unforgettable portrait of what it feels like to resist a tyrannical dictator, live under ISIS occupation, brave bombs falling from the sky, and somehow survive with humanity intact. Angela Davis calls Brothers of the Gun a revelatory and necessary read on one of the most destructive wars of our time. And Pankaj Mishra adds, from the anarchy, torment, and despair of the Syrian war, Marwan Hisham and Molly Crabapple have drawn a book of startling emotional power and intellectual depth. Many books will be written on the war's exhaustive devastation of bodies and souls and the defiant resistance of many trapped men and women, but the Mahabharata of the Levant has already found its wisest chroniclers. Welcome to Between the Covers, Molly Crabapple.
Oh, my pleasure to be here, and thanks for such a lovely introduction.
So the origin of this story is pretty remarkable. So I was hoping we could start with how you encountered Marwan Hisham and how you began collaborating for your Vanity Fair project together.
Back in 2013, I was doing journalism about the Syrian war and about the refugee crisis, and there was a small circle of people on Twitter. Some of them were Syrians, you know, some refugees, some people in the diaspora. Others were Western journalists and analysts, but we would all kind of talk about the war. And Marwan was one of those people. And at first, I was drawn to talking about him because on his Twitter bio, it said that he was in Raqqa. And at that time, Raqqa was under a brutal occupation by ISIS. And I was like, I can't believe it. I mean, look at the balls on this guy. He's tweeting under ISIS. So I started talking to Marwan privately. At first, he was a source for some of my articles. He would give me information about various aspects of daily life under ISIS that wasn't really getting into the media. But as I started studying Arabic, we started to become much closer friends. And perhaps maybe 6 months into our online friendship, I asked Marwan, hey, you know, do you have any photos of daily life in Raqqa? Just the type of thing that we would all have on our phone, right? You know, we all take photos. That's our world. And he told me he didn't, but he offered to take some photos. And despite my many naggings I gave him to stay safe, he repeatedly risked his life, because he's an amazing journalist, to take some of the most revelatory images I've seen coming out of Raqqa at that time. He took photos of kids digging in the trash for stuff to sell, took photos inside an ISIS hospital of the breadlines. And this was such an extraordinary thing, because to take photos under ISIS, that meant to be a spy. That was a death penalty offense under them. And yet he did it anyway because of his belief that images that were non-stereotypical, images of the city that he grew up in, needed to get out. I drew from these photos, but I also knew that Marwan was a writer. He had graduated with an English literature degree from the finest university in his country, and he told me that he liked to, you know, write political commentaries for fun. And I said, you know, why don't you write some captions for these and publish it in Vanity Fair? About a week before our piece went up, Marwan broke the news of the U.S. airstrikes on Raqqa. He had gotten so used to living under bombs that when a plane that was considerably nicer than the Syrian regime's planes dropped some bombs or some Hellfire missiles right near the cafe where he worked, he was immediately able to identify that it was American just from the noise of the plane. Hmm. And he broke that news 20 minutes before the Pentagon did.
So when you received these photos that you then transformed into illustrative art, I would imagine there would be quite a bit of reconfiguring or even some imaginative process that goes on in your part. Because, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but given the danger to Marwan, I would imagine he's not spending a lot of time with composition, for instance, that these would be photos that he'd be taking in weird positions or in ways in which it doesn't look like he's taking a photograph.
Exactly. There's a really funny story that he talks about in the book where he was hiding his phone behind his falafel sandwich. So all of the photos are taken, you know, pretty far away. Sometimes they're quite blurry, you know, at weird, like, upside down angles. Sometimes he would take several photos of one scene. And so because of that, it wasn't like I was copying a photo. It was more like I was looking through his eyes, and then I was choosing what element that I was going to focus on. Or in some cases where photos were taken over a period of 10 minutes, there might be one where there was like some moms with kids walking, but then there's another photo where they weren't there. And so I would like kind of, you know, put the two together. And I still remember, my God, when I got those photos, it was one of the most extraordinary experiences of my artistic life, because the only way that a journalist, a Western journalist, was going to enter Raqqa at that time was if they were wearing an orange jumpsuit and starring in a beheading video. And yet, here I had the immense privilege of seeing. I got to see through Marwan's eyes. I mean, you know, kind of made me shake when I got those photos the first time.
And when you moved from the Vanity Fair project together to working on this memoir of living under the Syrian war, you expanded the sources that you would use for images that then became drawings. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that process was and what some of the sources are for the images that we encounter in the book?
In my first three collaborations with Marwan, I was working exclusively from photos he took. But as we decided to do this book, we realized that there were just things that he couldn't have photos of. Some of these things were from the deep past, like when he was at religious school, for instance. Others of them were things that it would have been impossible, like enslaved Yazidi women that were brought into his cafe, and photos that even if he could have taken them, he wouldn't have, because it would have violated those women's dignity and their privacy. For stuff like this, we had to rely on tons of different sources, In general, I had two different processes. Some of the pictures I'm proudest of in this book are these huge, huge crowd scenes I did of protests. The way I would do these was I would look for a citizen video that had been taken of these protests at the time. And this video, it's really hard to make out if you don't know what's going on, because the people who are taking it, they're not journalists. They're guys with camera phones running away from live ammo and rubber bullets and clouds of tear gas. So everything is blurry, everything is chaotic. But if you know how to look at them, there's a lot of information. What I would do is I would take these videos and I would stop them, I'd pause them over and over again, and I would freeze frame them. And then I'd print out maybe like 50, 100 freeze frames from the video, and I would lay them all out on my table. And very often when these videos were freeze framed, you couldn't even make out the people because they were so blurry, they looked like smears. So I would repose models as these people so that I could get stuff like arms and hands right. And then from this, I would make massive crowd scenes, and I would try to make it feel as much as it possibly could like you were there with all of the motion and the chaos and people moving as one, all of the smoke from the burning tires, all the tear gas, all the people holding up their iPhones. I tried to like put it all into one thing. I was really, really inspired by Goya's disasters of war throughout the book. I even did the same amount of illustrations as he did. And for those ones in particular, I looked very closely and very technically at how he worked. Well, that was one type of process. But there were other illustrations that were more personal, that were, for instance, the picture of the Yazidi women. And for illustrations like that, I relied on Marwan's memory. I don't regard these illustrations as mine alone in this book. I regard them as both of ours, because he art directed them so heavily to make sure that they were authentic and that they were true. For the image of the Yazidi women, Marwan was so adamant that this was not going to be some sappy Western cliche. This was not going to be some Madonna and Child knockoff. He remembered exactly what those women looked like. He remembered everything from the carelessness of one of the women's hands to the shock in her daughter's eyes to the exact way that their hijabs were tied behind their necks. And what we did was I drew sketch after sketch. I remember even I would draw sketches of different ways like the young girl's mouth could be, right? Or different hand gestures. And he'd tell me, no, make the fingers looser. No, make her eyes wider. No, this, no, that. I was so frustrated by the end. I think we both wanted to throttle each other. But finally, I got something that was true to what he saw. He compared the process to downloading his memories.
Hmm. Well, what's interesting about that, about your statement that he was a co-maker of these images, even though you were the one whose hand was drawing them, is that even though this is his narrative, you were also the co-writer of the book. Can you talk about the ways in which you were co-writing the text of the book?
Oh, God, I can. At the start of this, I didn't realize why people don't co-write with each other usually, but by the end of it, I think both of us do, which is that writers are egomaniacs. And you know the classic saying, kill your darlings, right? So when you co-write with someone, it's more like you take each other's darlings hostage so that your darlings can live, or else their darlings gets it. So me and Marwan worked on this book for 3 years. I went to Istanbul over a dozen times to write with him. The birth of the book was notes that Marwan took on his phone when he was in Raqqa. He had always wanted to write a book, but he imagined that he would do it as a 70-year-old man, you know, looking back on this. He didn't think that it was something that was going to happen anytime soon. But he knew that he was living through history, and he wanted to record that as best he could. The way that we worked was we took these notes that Marwan wrote and, you know, additional stuff that he had written, and then laid them all out, saw what are stuff that we need more, what are stuff that we need less. And Marwan and me, but primarily Marwan, worked on a structure. Then what I did is I sat next to him and I interviewed him the way that you'd interview a source as a journalist. And I interviewed him in the most detail-oriented, probably excruciatingly annoying way, where I'd be like, tell me about the checkpoint. How high was the wall around the checkpoint? What did the guy at the checkpoint look like? He was wearing a suicide vest. What type of suicide vest? That sort of thing. And I would just type while I was sitting next to him. And eventually, you know, we had a book where I had written half and he had written half, or we had a draft. But this is where the reason that our process is unusual comes in. Then he took my draft and I took his draft, or we took our halves, and we rewrote each other. So Marwan, he has an English lit degree, as I said, and I dropped out of Fashion Institute of Technology, which ought to give you an idea, perhaps, of the different types of readings we've both done. Marwan is someone who reads Derrida. He knows, like, Noam Chomsky's linguistics. He translated Waiting for Godot for fun during university into Arabic. He has a really intense literary background, and he particularly has a passion for stuff that is oblique and mysterious, stuff that plays with time, stuff that messes around with sentence structure. Whereas I got my start writing as a journalist, and so my natural instinct was perhaps less Joyce and more Orwell. He would look at my stuff and he would say, no, we're not going to do it in this, like, straightforward, basic way. We are going to play with time. We're going to make it more sophisticated. He also has this total contempt for the way that books on the Middle East very often have to spoon feed basic information to the readers. How a book on Syria will literally have to start with, Syria is a country in the Middle East. It's predominantly Muslim, but there is an Alawite minority. He would be, oh my God, can't people Google? What's wrong with them? Why do we have to take ourselves out of the plot to do these, like, digressions of Middle East 101 college courses that people ought to know anyway? So he would just go through with the red pen of justice and XXX, wrong. Meanwhile, with his portions, I looked at them from a few standpoints. The first was Marwan has never been outside of Syria and a few neighboring countries. And so he had no idea of the vast, impossible depths of ignorance in the U.S. about the Middle East. And often he would, for instance, mention the events of 1982. And I would say, no one in the U.S. knows what the events of 1982 are. No one in the U.S. knows that Hafez al-Assad murdered tens of thousands of people in Hama, putting down a Muslim Brotherhood revolt. And so, you know, you can't say this expecting it to have the same emotional resonance it would have in Syria. I would try to make it something that was accessible and legible to American readers. Also, very often, I would push back on different perspectives. I'd ask him, for instance, under ISIS, I would ask him, what about women, you know, Marwan? And I would rewrite his side with these concerns in view. And then we would rewrite each other again and again and again, to the point where every single sentence, I think, has multiple revisions of each of us. And then the editor would come, and then he would say, do this, do that, and rewrite, until we have this book. And this is the hardest and most precious project I've ever done. While I do realize that the reason that people don't collaborate like this is because it's intensely difficult and it requires putting your ego on hold to create art, I think that we both grew enormously as writers. My friend Sinan Antun, who's also one of my favorite novelists, I was describing the process to him and he was like, sounds excruciating but exhilarating. Which,
yeah, it sounds amazing. I mean, it does sound painful, but it does sound amazing also. I wanted to ask you about when you were doing your Guantanamo project, you said that you wanted to find the story of one detainee as sort of an entryway into something immense. And it feels like Marwan Hisham is the perfect entryway. And the reason I say that is because he seems to be inherently curious and also inherently skeptical. So he's skeptical of the Assad regime, but he's also skeptical of the religious upbringing that he had. He questions everything that sort of comes prepackaged and delivered to him. So that imagining another narrator into this war who maybe readily takes a side, it would be an entirely different book. Instead, we see this man who is watching everyone else take sides. And I just wanted to hear more about whether that was just good luck on your part in this, in finding each other and him becoming the sort of guide, or was that also part of when you were encountering him initially that you felt like this was the person I want to collaborate on in terms of a memoir in the Syrian war?
Yeah, he's an extraordinary person. He's one of the most skeptical, cynical, yet idealistic people I've ever met. Probably one of like the truest, most natural-born journalists. I think the reason that I wanted to work with Marwan so much, and I actually would never have written this book with anyone else. And I know many amazing Syrian journalists. I know many amazing Syrians with all sorts of fascinating stories, but I wouldn't have done this book with anyone but Marwan. And in part, it's directly because of that, because he's someone who has this intense moral courage to look at everything with the same sort of lacerating sharpness, and including himself, right? Including every single sacred thing. And I don't just mean sacred in terms of religion, I mean sacred in terms of politics, right? I mean sacred in terms of sort of the local loyalties that you would have. He turns the same sort of sharp questioning eye to all of it. It's a courage I know that I wouldn't even have for myself. I wrote a memoir myself, and I know exactly how hard it is, and I know the things that I wouldn't say in my own memoir. But that courage and that intellect was why I wanted to work with him so much.
Well, maybe this is a good time where we could hear a little bit of the prose.
This passage is about one of Marwan's memories from his childhood. When he was a young boy, the country was under the dictatorship of Hafez al-Assad, who is the father of Bashar al-Assad, the current dictator of Syria. And this is about the semi-religious worship of this very secular leader. When I was 9 years old, I thought Hafez al-Assad was the president of the entire world. When I was bored during lectures, I would stare up at the portrait of our comrade, the father and the leader, looming over us from the front of the classroom. He smiled down gently, his suit sharp, his tie silvery, prayer beads frozen mid-click between his hands. This portrait wasn't just in the classroom, of course, but everywhere I looked. Hafez al-Assad was our patriarch, the unbeatable general who had delivered our country to safety by seizing control of the government in what he called the corrective movement. A beloved father who, every 7 years, won a landslide election with no less than 99% of our votes. On every possible occasion, we saluted him, marched in his praise, wrote poems in his honor. Sometimes we confused him for God. Each morning, we queued up in the playground while a teacher led us through the slogans. Now I understood what it felt like to lose your individuality. I was lost like those men in that Sufi circle. We students in our rows shouted each line of the slogans until the triumphant finish, "Our leader forever, Comrade Hafez al-Assad." My father had other ideas. "In your heart, replace the last three words with Muhammad, Messenger of God," my father told me, protesting when I described our daily pledge. "No other man shall be my leader forever," my father thought, least of all a man he deemed an enemy of our religion for transforming himself into a deity in our godly land. 2 years later, an event happened that defied the logic of our world. Impossibly, our father and comrade died. The country plunged into an ecstasy of mourning. It took me months to absorb that a god could perish. His death birthed thousands of brand new Hafez al-Assads. His image returned to us in photos, drawings, sculptures, and Ba'ath Party flags affixed to every surface. Syrian flags unfurled into infinity, their two central stars green and sharp as vipers' eyes. Another adjective was added to his name, and thus he became the immortal comrade, Hafez al-Assad.
We've been listening to Molly Crabapple read from her co-written memoir, Brothers of the Gun, a memoir of the Syrian war with Marwan Hisham. So you mentioned one of the challenges of writing a book of the Syrian war is, I think, the immense ignorance of American readership. But another is just this complexity of narrative. This is not a simple good versus evil. So much like with you in the Arab Spring, which sort of was part of a year of you really pivoting into this new innovative form of illustrated journalism and writing, the Arab Spring prompted Marwan to go to his first protest in Syria. And that's really the only point in the book where things are simple. This impulse to want a more representative, participatory government and a country that isn't just living on the nostalgia of sort of past glories, but also looking towards a future where the people's wishes are more represented. But what's really interesting as we follow Marwan in this is even before there's any foreign powers, even before there's ISIS, Russia, Iran, Israel, the US and Europe fighting a proxy war in Syria, just the rebel groups versus Assad's regime, with 23 different rebel groups, all with their own various agendas, is a bewildering narrative. And I was interested in hearing how you both confronted that. I mean, we have that tendency to begin with, regardless, even putting aside the ignorance of good versus bad. And yet here we have just a kaleidoscope, essentially, of actors that are in Syria prior even to the foreign intervention.
It's an incredibly complicated war. And one of the first questions that Syrian protesters were faced with was even whether or not to militarize. Many people never wanted to pick up guns. They wanted it to be a purely peaceful uprising. Marwan himself was one of those people. There are figures in Syria like Khaith Matar, who was called Little Gandhi, who would present soldiers with flowers and bottles of water. But Khaith Matar was tortured to death by the government. And in some ways, the intense, intense brutality with which the government responded virtually forced many people to pick up guns. And part of the reason that there are so many of these small rebel groups is because many times the reason that people first picked up guns was that government troops and Shabiha, these are like sort of criminals that are paid by the government, armed government supporters that were allowed to do crimes. Shabiha would go into people's neighborhoods and they would invade people's houses and they would rape people and they would take people off. And a lot of times people didn't arm up with the idea that they were going to like invade a city. They armed up saying, I don't want anyone to come into my house and, you know, take my kid away and torture them. And a lot of the groups in Syria, and the reason that there is so much of a kaleidoscope, came from the fact that these groups were not things that started with a top-down, you know, general leading everything. These groups were essentially the equivalent of like neighborhood watch groups of local guys trying to protect their block that they lived on. And one of, I think, the tragedies of the opposition side of the war, and this is something Marwan talks about, but also if anyone wants a more exhaustive catalog of this, they should read Rania Abu Zayed's No Turning Back, which is an amazing book on the war in Syria too. One of the tragedies of the Syrian war was that the opposition side was never able to unify because of the vast array of foreign backers, each with their own agenda, most specifically Saudi Arabia and Qatar, solving their beefs by pitting rebel groups against each other.
Mm. Well, one of the ways I think that this book really tells the story in a way that we can grasp is by following the brothers that are referred to in the title, The Brothers of the Gun. So Marwan has two friends, one a visual artist and one a poet, who we watch as Marwan tries to stay in this position of staying connected to his humanity and his values. We watch his friends making other decisions connected to their own. So can you tell us a little bit about the two brothers and Marwan's following of how they diverge?
Niall and Tariq were two guys that Marwan grew up with who were his very, very close friends. Niall was someone that when Marwan was telling me about his character, I really identified with him. He was a visual artist from he's from a poor family in Raqqa, had to work like really hard. He even was left back a year in school because he like was working too hard at his job loading trucks to take tests. But he was incredibly passionate about art, and he finally got the chance to study at the Damascus University of Fine Art, which is the best art school in the country. And in Damascus, he totally reinvented himself, right down to trying to ditch his Raqqawi accent, which is a more rural accent, for a more fancy city Damascus accent. And that was the path he was going on, of being kind of like an artist hipster, until the revolution happened. And he took part in protests. And Niall, the thing that changed everything for him was that Niall was arrested. And when he was arrested, he saw people being tortured and also religiously humiliated. One of the very radicalizing things that the government forces did during the war was that they would torture people and force them to say things like, Bashar al-Assad is my God. And this isn't something that's hearsay. This is something that government forces made videos of that ended up on YouTube, that were just horrific, dignity-crushing, disgusting torture videos. And that was something that Niall witnessed firsthand. And once he saw this, he became convinced that the regime was way too brutal to ever be negotiated with, that if they just kept going to peaceful protests, they'd just be slaughtered like a bunch of sheep, and that the only way to get the regime to cease murdering people and to fall was to join an armed group. Niall joined a local armed group, and he died very early in the war. He died fighting against the government. Niall's brother, Tariq, initially hadn't really wanted to be involved in the war. He had been an early protester, but then he had gone to university in Beirut, where he was studying Arabic literature and working at a cafe and living really the sort of life that any young man would envy. He even had like a cool motorcycle, you know? He had a great life there. But when Niall was killed, Tariq immediately went back to Syria, determined to avenge his brother's death. And he joined the first group that seemed like it wasn't thieves, basically, and that seemed effective, which was a fundamentalist Islamist group called Ahrar al-Sham. And Ahrar al-Sham was not a group that Tariq would have ideologically identified with or felt close to before the war at all. But as the war progressed, he adopted more and more of their ideology and eventually became an extremely battle-hardened soldier and a sniper. And for much of the war, he primarily fought against ISIS.
And that's an interesting point, too, because he joined a fundamentalist Islamist group and was fighting ISIS. I would imagine most people without a lot of knowledge of what's going on would just collapse all the Islamist groups into ISIS, and similarly would think that all secularism was the same, whereas people who were fighting Assad were also fearful of like an Ataturk-style secularism. So even though they were fighting a secularist government, that didn't mean that they wanted like a Turkish style of secularism, which is so fascinating to be able to walk through with someone there and parse out these nuances when something like this tends to, I think, resist complexity when we get it presented to us in the news. Could you speak to the cover image of Tariq playing the machine gun as a violin, and both why you chose it as a cover image and what's behind that image in the first place?
The cover image is actually drawn from a self-portrait that Tariq took and posted on his Instagram that Marwan gave to me. And I think the reason that Marwan and also I like this image so much is that it shows a man who is completely immersed in war and death to the point where he's this close to his gun, but also a man who, before the war, was someone deeply engaged with beauty. I mean, he wrote poetry throughout the war. He had an Instagram where he took these astoundingly talented photos. And it's like he was trying to hold on to that part of himself, even though he is surrounded by killing and death. The reason that Marwan chose this image is that Tariq died in the last days of us doing this book. He was killed fighting, and Marwan wanted this to be a tribute to him. Marwan disagreed with Tariq on almost everything, but he was still someone that he admired for pursuing his beliefs until the end, and someone who he had grown up with.
Would you be willing to read the epigraph to the book, the poem at the beginning?
Of course. We started the book with a poem by Muhammad al-Maghout, who is an amazing Syrian poet that unfortunately isn't really translated into English, and who lived for quite a long time near Raqqa. Marwan did this translation himself. They gave us watches and took away time. They gave us shoes and took the paths. They gave us parliaments and took freedom. They gave us playground swings and took celebrations. They gave us dried milk and took childhood. They gave us fertilizers and took spring. They gave us guards and locks and took safety. They gave us rebels and took the revolution.
We've been listening to Molly Crabapple read from her co-written memoir, Brothers of the Gun, a memoir of the Syrian war with Marwan Hisham. I'd like to return to something you mentioned at the beginning, that the 82 images in this book are related to the 82 paintings by Goya, the Disasters of War. Can you speak to what Goya's Disasters of War was addressing and why you wanted to have this sort of mirroring with what he was doing?
Goya's Disasters of War were a series of etchings that he did. They were a series of images he did that were about the Napoleonic invasion of Spain and the related atrocities. These images were not done at the time. They were done later, and they were done in the shadow of a Spain that was still dominated by the Inquisition. And they're images that in some ways are journalistic and in some ways are not. Some of them show firing squads, or they show, I remember there's one of a woman who is very, very famous for loading the cannon and firing when all the men in her village were dead. Others, though, show impossible images, images that couldn't exist, that were surreal, like bodies in trees, a woman holding up her dead lover, but the dead lover almost is weightless and is physically impossible the way that he's standing. There are images that, in their surrealism, show aspects of the horrors of war that perhaps something more naturalistic couldn't adequately convey. I also looked at them very closely for the technical aspects. I hadn't planned to do this book in black and white. All of our collaborations before that were in color. But the publishers wanted to do it in black and white so that it would be easier to sell translations. And as soon as I knew that I was going to look at it, as soon as I knew that I was going to do it in black and white, I had to look at the greatest master of black and white war drawings in history. I tried to draw both from like more philosophical aspects of what he was doing, but also like very technical aspects of gray wash and white and framing. Luckily, in the course of doing this book, there was actually an exhibition of Goya at the Brooklyn Museum, and I got to look at them in person, and I would stick my face right up to the drawings, and I would see exactly how he made each and every one of those little lines that was so apt and so perfect and so dark.
Mm. Well, in reading about it myself, it was interesting to discover that because of the immediacy and also the brutality and the way that the scenes extended beyond the frame, that his etchings were compared to 20th century photojournalism before there were photographs, which feels like a real link to you and the way that you are illustrating photographs for this project. Can you speak to the ways in which you feel like illustration has an advantage, if you believe so, over photography, or even illustrations of photography, what it can offer that perhaps photography by itself can't?
The greatest strength and weakness of photography is that a photographer has to be there. That's why photojournalists are the most brave journalists that you can ever meet, because they're actually the ones that are in the front line there with their camera, risking all of the bullets themselves. They can't just stay back at their hotel, right, and get dispatches. They're right in the thick of everything. This is part of what makes photography so powerful, right? You're seeing it firsthand. This is why photography can be used as proof, you know, that war crimes happened. It's why photography can change things in so many ways. But it's also a weakness, right? Because power likes to censor places. And there's a lot of places that you cannot take a camera into. You can't take cameras into prisons. It's very hard to take photos in military checkpoints. There are all sorts of totalitarian regimes, of which I include ISIS as one of them, that either severely limit or ban photos. So if you had to rely on photography alone, whole swaths of life and of the world, some of the most oppressive and dark swaths, would not be recorded. And this is where I believe that as artists, we have a huge advantage. I love Joe Sacco's Palestine, like everyone else. I'm sure that's no surprise. But one of the things I loved about it was that he interviews Palestinians that had been imprisoned by the Israelis. And obviously, there is not a photojournalist in someone's solitary cell. There will never be images of that. But what Sacco was able to do was he was able to interview these men and women who had been imprisoned and then draw their memories. He was able to take things that power did not want to be visually legible and make them visual, make people see what was supposed to be unseen. And this is something that I tried to do with the book as well. That's just one advantage. Another advantage is that I'm going to borrow a quote from Jeremy Scahill here, who's an amazing journalist I'm lucky enough to know. And he said that the ultimate way to scrub metadata from a photo is to draw it. These drawings, they hide people's identities, because it's not right to show the real faces of people who lived under ISIS or who were at protests. It's not right to do that. It could put them at risk. A photograph, in the same way that it can prove war crimes, it can also get activists locked up in jail, right?
And also with illustration, you can foreground the censorship that's happening. I know you did that in Guantanamo with, you weren't allowed to draw the faces of the guards, I believe, right?
Exactly. Guantanamo has the most stringent censorship under the pretext of what they call operational security, or OPSEC. You have a list of things you're not allowed to photograph. And at first that sounds doable, but then you quickly realize that if you're not photographing any doors, and if you're not photographing any cameras, and you're not photographing any faces, and you're not photographing like two architectural features in one drawing, what are you photographing? You're photographing the floor. In Guantanamo, I was able to just draw around that censorship. And most particularly, because I wasn't allowed to draw the faces of guards, I drew blank smiley face masks.
Well, I want to read just a brief quote that you said about writing, illustrating Discordia, about the Greek economic crisis, and then just ask you a little bit more about something that you say in it. So you said, as I illustrated Discordia, I found that drawings, like photojournalism, could distill the essential. Unlike photography, though, visual art has no pretense of objectivity. It is joyfully, defiantly subjective. Its truth is individual. Picasso's Guernica doesn't explain what a body looks like after a carpet bombing, but it does show the agony of war. When I drew, I could see nothing more clearly than the space between my art and its subject. And I wondered about this space between art and subject. It made me think of Teju Cole, who's a photographer, activist, writer, I'm sure whose work I'm guessing you probably know. And he asked John Berger why photography wasn't part of his practice. And Berger said that for him, to photograph a subject was to foreclose some part of what he could write about. He saw it as an interference to his writing faculties. And I wondered if that was something to do with this presence or absence of the space between art and subject, or if you feel any resonance with that sentiment.
It was a little bit different for me. When I talk about the space between my art and the subject, you're hanging out with these people who are living, flesh and blood people who are universes in themselves, you know, full of life and complexity and courage. And then when you try to draw them, or when I try to draw them at least, all I could see was all of the life that my picture lacked compared to them, right? And I would try and I would try and I would try and I would push myself to get better and better, but always I would feel that weight of all that there was about them that I couldn't express.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Molly Crabapple about Brothers of the Gun, Memoirs of the Syrian War, co-written by Marwan Hisham. Well, maybe this is a good time just to briefly mention why Marwan isn't with us here in this conversation. Why isn't he able to do the tour with you?
Man, so this is one of the reasons that doing the tour is actually rather melancholy for me, because Marwan can't join me. And the reason he can't join me is because of specific policies of three different countries, and I'll try to spell them out. The first is that the Syrian regime is incredibly vindictive to Syrians outside of Syria. It's done every possible thing it can to screw them over, including Bashar al-Assad saying there was lots of terrorists among the refugees going to Europe. And one of the things is that they make it extremely difficult and extremely expensive to get a passport. A passport that would cost maybe $25 inside the country can cost up to like $1,000 outside the country if you can even get an appointment, and that's not without all the bribes. And another reason that Marwan can't get a passport is because, like countless Syrian men, he didn't do his military service. There are thousands and thousands, I don't know if there's an exact number, but many tens of thousands of men who fled the country rather than killing their fellow citizens. And this is something that I consider to be an act of heroism. It's not cowardice, no matter how much the Tony Larens of the world want to paint it as that. These men are risking their lives to avoid murdering other people. And because these men did that, they're denied passports by the government. And in fact, they're actually on wanted lists. There was a list of 1.5 million people who are wanted for the government for questioning. And many of these are men who ditched their army service. So that's why he can't get his passport. Then there's the policies of Turkey, where Marwan is currently living. Turkey makes it very difficult for Syrians to get permanent residency. And because of this, it's quite possible that if someone leaves Turkey with a legitimate Syrian passport and visa, that they can't ever get back in. There are, I believe, three countries in the entire world right now that accept Syrians without visas, which are Ecuador, the Sudan, and Malaysia. And if you couldn't get back into Turkey, you would either have to go to one of them, or more likely, you'd share the fate of many Syrians now, which is being trapped in the airport and living in airport terminals. The third reason is we are living under Donald Trump, and it's very, very hard, nearly impossible for Syrians to get visas. I have a friend who is a trans woman living in Canada right now who was invited by Rutgers University to speak at an LGBT rights conference, and she paid her $600 to apply for a visa and was turned down and does not get the $600 back. Mm. And, she is a... she's a trans woman speaking at an LGBT conference, not a young man, right? So these things combine to make it to be basically impossible for him to come. I'm not saying that perhaps someone somewhere who has influence could have come, but for Marwan, it wasn't possible. And it's something I'm very sad about.
Yeah. Well, maybe as a way to end, I mean, what's really interesting about the way you've spoken about your collaboration with Marwan, that he was very instrumental to the drawings that you made, and you were very instrumental to the telling of his story in text and language. And then looking at when you're both asked about which books or music you would connect to this project, you pick mostly non-Western writers, and he picks mostly Western writers. Like, he mentions Atwood's Handmaid's Tale and Hannah Arendt's Eichmann in Jerusalem and George Orwell's homage to Catalonia. Maybe we can end with a little section on page 290 to 292. That's just a dramatization, I think, of the courage of him smuggling out the photos.
January 2016. The last month, the worst month. My Times and foreign policy articles are about to be published. The tension stretches painfully between the iPhone screen, the room, and the world. It's not funny anymore. ISIS is obsessed with spies. They released 3 videos of executions of men they claimed were spies, found guilty of sending pictures of fighters' headquarters through hidden cameras, or receiving money from abroad to open internet cafes. The videos were all the same. Orange jumpsuits, torture-induced, quote-unquote, confessions, bullets through the brains in Rashid Park. I erase every message I send, and the memories vanish with them. 2 Daesh guys walk into the cafe. They're laughing about the dirty pigs whom their colleagues had shot against Rashid Park's palm trees. I sign out of everything, then listen without looking. It would be too suspicious to look. 1 Tunisian fighter chuckles. We're catching a lot of spies lately in cafes. They get what they deserve. I sit with my phone shielded by a veil of coat, surrounded by fighters, potential ISIS spies, and potential ISIS victims, who need to watch every word they send and receive for anything that might offend the brothers. Otherwise, this so-called internet cafe will be the last place their eyes see in the sunlit world. I am caught, I think. They're talking about me. I am the pig, the spy, the kafir. I am everything they hate. I've been lucky for years. More than once, my phone was searched, and it was only the idiocy of the brothers who detained me that saved me. I survived, didn't I? I'm still alive. I still see sunlight. The blood is still rushing through my veins. I am still sharp enough to imagine in every ISIS bro's dumb eyes the demon who will catch me. I, who am here for no reason, with no one to blame but myself if I am caught. I thought I could establish myself in Turkey that last time, that I could work, that my money would stretch until I found a job. It went that way in my mind, but plans are different from reality. The money disappeared. I tried to find work in factories, but it's not life anyway, sweating your years away for 1/3 of what a Turk gets paid, and maybe you lose your fingers to a machine and end up with nothing. The path between Ankara and Raqqa had been my thread of safety. I knew I could be back in 44 hours, and at least here, even if this journalism thing didn't work, I wouldn't have to ask anyone for anything. I could keep my head up. That's what I thought. The blood was so loud in my ears. They won't just kill me. They'll kill my family, my friends, anyone who had been in contact with me, these decent people whom I had betrayed by working undercover, milking their stories, pretending I was like them, all dead because of me. I'm too careless, I think. This is not a joke anymore, nor is Raqqa the city it once was. 5 minutes pass. The Tunisian guys shush, then start browsing their phones. I stand and walk to the counter. Each step thunders. They will hear them. I force my right foot forward and then my left. I will fall and they will see. The air presses down on me so harsh my back will snap. I hand the slip of paper to the guy at the counter. It shows my username and password, so he can delete my account and thus prevent me from checking my phone outside the cafe and away from ISIS eyes. Assalamu alaikum, I say. Wa alaikum assalam, he answers. He smiles as if with recognition. This is normal, I tell myself. I'm in here every day. No, this is not normal. See how he's looking at me? He has memorized me. He suspects me. I have to leave as soon as I can. I have to leave today. I have to leave this f***ing hour. It's dark outside. I edge past the motorcycles into the narrow street that leads to my house. The asphalt has eroded to reveal dirt made into mud by the winter rains. 2 ISIS cars pass. I walk for 15 minutes, numb with fear. When I open the door to my parents' apartment, then fall onto the bed, a great luxury fills me. A concerto played with nerves, lymph, tendons, brain. I outwitted them, I tell myself. I did the job and then left safely. They will never catch me.
Thanks so much for being on the show today, Molly.
Thank you so much, and I just wish Marwan could be here with me.
Yeah, me too. We've been listening to Molly Crabapple, the co-author of Brothers of the Gun, Memoirs of the Syrian War. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
And you're tuned to Community Radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM, Hood River, 104.3 FM, Philomath and the Willamette Valley. This KBOO program is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from the Garden Spout, providing indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland.